devastation, destruction, and death in the aftermath of Hurricane Helene, Catholic dioceses and parishes step up to help. We are joined by three bishops from some of the hardest hit areas. War wages on between Israel and Gaza as tension between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon ratchets up. We speak to a regional expert from his home in Beirut. Center stage for the vice presidential candidates. Analysis from a Catholic perspective on what J.D. Vance and Tim Walz said about abortion, life, and support for the family. And faith through a Catholic lens, literally. On the road with a Catholic photographer on a mission to bring inspiration to the faithful. EWTN News in Depth starts now.
This is the most devastating thing I've ever seen in our whole city. I think that the loss of life, the fact that if you don't have cash, you can't get anything. We've gone to stores, water's out, ice is out. People slept overnight at gas stations. Like, I feel like we've never seen this before.
Scenes of destruction in the southeast as residents assess the damage left behind by Hurricane Helene. The storm brought with it historic rainfall, storm surges, and flooding across six states. The death toll has soared to over 200. It's unclear how many people are missing or accounted for as survivors attempt to make sense of the disaster. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. It's been a week since Hurricane Helene first made landfall, but even now, residents are still learning just how devastating the storm's 600-mile path was as rescuers reach stranded communities and search miles of debris for missing persons. Historic, post-apocalyptic, biblical. These are the words residents are using to describe Helene's path of destruction, from record-breaking storm surge in Florida to deadly flooding in Tennessee. With more than 200 people dead and counting, Helene has become the second deadliest hurricane in the U.S. in 50 years, surpassed only by Hurricane Katrina in 2005.
It's pretty shocking. I don't think anyone really prepared for it to be this high of water.
Hurricane Helene began its path of destruction in Florida, before turning north toward Georgia, the Carolinas, eastern Tennessee, and parts of southwest Virginia. Even as it diminished into a tropical storm and then a depression, Helene wrought deadly winds and flooding. Within hours, houses and even entire communities flattened or washed away. Thousands of residents are being housed in shelters, and in regions like western North Carolina, search and rescue teams work around the clock to find hundreds of missing persons.
Still, the number one priority is making sure that we are saving lives. There are 92 search and rescue teams who are active right now and who are still bringing people to safety.
The mountainous and sparse landscape of the Tar Heel State poses special challenges for relief efforts already delayed by communications outages and decimated road systems. In some rural communities, residents rely on relief delivered by helicopter and even by mule. Local Catholic churches throughout the region are following Christ's command to love thy neighbor. After the storm hit North Carolina on Friday, the Diocese of Charlotte checked in with every pastor to assess damage and survey immediate needs.
From that moment on, we've been mobilizing, getting our resources out to those people who are in need. Basic things, diapers, baby food, water, things of that nature.
Churches serve as aid distribution points throughout the diocese, and parishioners are donating goods and time to help those in need.
It's been really beautiful that people have, neighbors have come out, and they're checking on their neighbors. And
Father Joshua Johnson is the pastor of St. Edmund Campion Church, a small parish just over a year old in Henderson County, North Carolina. He ensured every parishioner in his flock was accounted for after the devastating storm.
Of course, everybody was without power, and we had a few parishioners that had trees fall on their house.
After the storm, Father Johnson reached out to the faithful in the area on Facebook, coordinating generator delivery for parishioners.
We've been able to find people that have generators that they're not using, and trying to get those up to people that could use a generator so they can, you know, wash their clothes and just do some basic things like that. And if people don't have a generator, then they're offering, you know, hey, you can come over and wash your clothes, get a shower.
Along with ensuring his parishioners' physical needs are met, Father Johnson is also providing spiritual accompaniment, bringing the sacraments to those who are unable to make it to church and encouraging parishioners to keep praying. On Sunday, he offered a sunlit mass in their powerless church for those who could make it.
This was so important to them, and just encouraging them to offer whatever, you know, the suffering and the loss to Jesus in the Eucharist and unite that with him. That's the most important thing they can do right now as they seek to love God and their neighbor.
We are joined now by three U.S. bishops leading Catholic Church relief efforts from areas that are experiencing some of the worst of Hurricane Helene's devastation. Bishop Michael Martin of the Diocese of Charlotte, North Carolina, is here. The Diocese of Knoxville's Bishop Mark Beckman joins us from Eastern Tennessee. And Bishop Gregory Parks of the Diocese of St. Petersburg joins us from the Tampa Bay area in Florida. Your Excellencies, thank you all for being here, especially this week in particular. Bishop Martin, I want to go to you first. You are speaking to us from a school in your diocese that was flooded out last week. You're on location. You can tell that internet signal is still not strong. Half of your diocese has been declared a disaster zone. What is the reality for the Charlotte Diocese right now?
Thanks so much for having us today and for continuing to tell the story of so many folks who every day now are facing a reality that is tough for us to comprehend. It's pretty devastating. I've been here this morning at one of our schools, which has become somewhat a real place of respite and a place for folks just to get simple things like water, food, diapers for so many. And so just talking to people that have been driving through the line and receiving whatever we have here to give has been very humbling to see the devastation that's taken place here. So God is good, and we believe in a resurrection, not just in the life to come, but in this life as well. And so I feel confident that God's grace will continue to sustain us even amidst this difficulty.
Absolutely. Bishop Beckman, I understand you met with hurricane survivors this week, parishioners of the diocese who had to be rescued from raging floodwaters. You even met with families of hurricane victims who are still missing. Tell us about those visits and what you're hearing from those survivors in your diocese.
Yes, indeed. I think that was probably, we spent Wednesday, much of the day up in the areas that were affected by the hurricane. And the thing that the two lasting memories that I've taken with me are the group of people that we met with who were at a grief support group at our local parish there in Irwin. And there were people there who were grieving the loss of someone that had died in the floodwaters, people who had died in the floodwaters. There were people who were there that had witnessed people being swept away in the waters. And there were also people who whose loved ones have not yet been found. Mm. So the palpable grief in that room has stayed with me. And the second location was the press conference where they were addressing the rescue and response efforts. And some of the family members were holding up photographs of their loved ones that are still missing. And just the heartbreak of them trying to figure out where their loved ones might be and if they will be found. So I think those are the moments that most profoundly affected me.
Absolutely.
But I will also add that I was incredibly touched by the response that's going on in our diocese. We've had so many volunteers who've been part of reaching out, providing water and other resources. So very grateful for all of those things.
Absolutely. Bishop Parks, I happen to be a Tampa Bay native myself, and I know that that area tends to be largely spared by hurricanes. And Tampa did not get a direct hit, but the region experienced surprise historic storm surges. Tell us about the situation on the ground where you are and how your flock has been impacted.
Sure. Thanks, Catherine. You know, one of the wonderful and beautiful things about this diocese is that we have a lot of water around us. All five counties of my diocese border or touch the Gulf of Mexico in some way. Mm-hmm. But of course, when you have a storm, that blessing and what makes it a great area becomes a hazard. And there was historic flooding, even though the eye of Hurricane Helene stayed about 100 miles offshore from the St. Petersburg and Tampa Bay area. The main thing that we dealt with or are dealing with is the storm surge. Any parish or school or home that was either close to or on the water in the diocese likely is experiencing severe damage. Mm-hmm. It wasn't so much the wind, although we did have winds up in the 80 mile per hour range, you know, which caused some roof damage, some tiles to come off. But it was the incredible storm surge. One of our parishes, St. John Vianney, which is on St. Pete Beach, had 5 to 6 feet of storm water flooding in the church and in the school. Their offices were flooded. And the rectory as well. Mm. And when you get water in a building, it's just devastating. So we're trying to recover.
As the death toll from Helene continues to rise, Bishop Martin, the aftermath from Hurricane Helene is being compared to that of 2005's Hurricane Katrina. What do you make of that comparison so far and the media coverage of the hurricane's devastation?
I think for people who are hurting and people who have experienced tremendous misery, there is no comparison. I think your misery is yours, and it's awful. And I don't think that we can. And any loss of life is tragic for that person and for their family. And so I don't know that the comparison helps at all, other than to acknowledge the hope of what it will take to try and help folks to reestablish their lives in some form or fashion. Bishop and I were on the phone yesterday and just talking about some of the experiences that he just shared as well that I have, and just people whose, you know, trailer parts that are gone. Mm-hmm. And where will these people begin to try to start their lives again? I my sister and brother-in-law moved to New Orleans 2 weeks before Katrina, and they lost everything. And so I have a brief sense of what that is like. But I do believe in the power of the Holy Spirit to even take something powerful from that and to bring something even greater out of it. And so I hope. And I hope I can share that with the people here in our diocese.
Absolutely. We have to live in that hope. Bishop Beckman, it's in moments of profound tragedy that we can often see the local church stepping up and responding. You've mentioned it already, but how has the Catholic community in your area been serving those most in need right now?
Well, one of the things that I've noticed is Catholic Charities of East Tennessee jumped right in and began to mobilize supplies and volunteers. So when we arrived at the parishes up in the northeastern part of our diocese that have been most affected, there were supplies, lots of bottled water everywhere, and many volunteers at work, and also grief support for those who have been affected directly by loss of life. Mm. So to see a whole network of people who are on the ground up there. One of our parishes up there is very remote. It's staffed by the Glenmary priest. And literally, as Father Tom was walking about with us, all of the local townspeople were expressing their great gratitude to him for everything that the community up there is doing. Mm. And many times it's the local schools and churches that are contact areas to provide assistance to people. And I saw that both in parish settings and also in public school settings up in the Northeast.
Outside of the loss of life, we are seeing many reports of families losing everything they have, their home, furniture, clothes, sentimental belongings, having to start all over. Bishop Parks, how can the church provide both spiritual and material support for those families?
I think, first of all, and Bishop Beckman just mentioned this, Catholic Charities has been really amazing, you know, in the early days following the storm, in terms of trying to provide immediate assistance to those who are hurting and in need. We also, several years ago, established a disaster relief fund here in our diocese. And so we have some resources available, but those are also limited. I think each parish is doing their best to reach out to their particular communities. I was very, very impressed with one of our parishes. I think it was the day after the storm or the following day, they organized a community event, an outreach in which members of the parish went throughout the community to help residents remove furniture and carpets and things that were damaged, you know, from the storm. So I think really in the end that the church can really be a place and a sign of hope to the greater community, that with God's help and with our faith and with our charity to one another, that we can rebuild.
And we do have to come together. Bishop Martin, we have about 1 minute left, but I do want to ask you this. So many of your churches were impacted by the storm, and I imagine amidst this tragedy, your flock is hungry for the sacraments. Will they still be able to access the sacraments as the diocese repairs and rebuilds?
Absolutely. One of the things that's been a tremendous joy for me has been the faithfulness of the priests and deacons and our seminarians even of our diocese, and making certain that spiritual service continues to be offered in every one of our places of worship throughout the diocese. And so continue to keep our priests, and certainly I'm sure Bishop Parks and Bishop Beckman could say the same thing in their dioceses. These are men who are really heroic in what they're trying to do to continue to not only create community and to serve the needs of people who whose lives have been turned upside down, but also to nourish them spiritually through the sacraments. That will not cease.
Mm. Bishop Martin, Bishop Beckman, Bishop Parks, we join our prayers with yours. Thank you for your time this week.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Catherine.
God bless. As the bishops mentioned, Catholic Charities agencies across the South are on the front lines, providing critical relief and supporting victims. You can support these efforts by making a donation. Go to CatholicCharitiesUSA.org to learn more. When we come back, another area of crisis as tensions escalate in the Middle East between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon. We talk to a global human rights leader from his home in Beirut about the growing odds of a full-blown regional war. EWTN News in Depth continues in a moment.
We are definitely at a very, very dangerous moment. We are literally on the brink of a regional conflict. You cannot control all of the variables. So this could literally engulf more countries.
What many in the world had hoped to avoid appears imminent. Outbreak of a regional war in the Middle East. Israel extends what it calls a limited ground war into southern Lebanon against the militant group Hezbollah as Iran bombards Israel with hundreds of ballistic missiles after Israel launched an airstrike into Lebanon that killed Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah. What began as a war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza 1 year ago, after Hamas terrorists stormed into Israel on October 7th, killing 1,200 people and taking more than 100 hostages, has now erupted into clashes with Hezbollah in Lebanon, Iranian missile attacks on Israel, and Israeli attacks on the pro-Iranian Houthis in Yemen. The Israel escalation into southern Lebanon began in earnest several weeks ago as it pummeled Iran-backed Hezbollah with airstrikes, set off exploding electronic devices, assassinated the group's leader with a missile attack in the suburbs of Beirut, and then on Monday launched a ground operation aimed at restoring security along Israel's northern border. Over the past year, thousands of Jewish settlers in northern Israel have left their homes because of repeated cross-border attacks by Hezbollah. Now, as Israeli troops advance into southern Lebanon, Israel has told Lebanese civilians to evacuate villages there. Lebanese officials estimate the number of displaced people at more than 1 million. to discuss the escalating situation from his home in Beirut, Lebanon. We are joined by human rights activist Dr. Habib Malik. He is a retired professor of history and cultural studies at the Lebanese American University and currently works for the Charles Malik Institute at the Philos Project. Charles Malik, Habib's father, was Lebanon's first ambassador to the U.S. He was instrumental in shaping the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Dr. Malik, thank you for joining us. Before we talk about the broader regional tensions and how we got there, let's talk about your personal situation. You are joining us from your home in Beirut as Israeli airstrikes batter your city's southern suburbs. What are you seeing and what are you hearing from your friends and neighbors?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you for having me, and thanks to EWTN. I live in the greater Beirut area, meaning I live outside the city technically on a residential hill overlooking the Mediterranean and the city. This means we hear everything, all of the explosions we hear, but we are so far away from any direct action. Now, the bombing, frankly, is really all over the country, except that it's very targeted. And this is interesting because the Israelis, before this current escalation, spoke several times about returning Lebanon to the Stone Age in the case of all-out war. And this seems to have lulled Hezbollah into thinking that, well, Lebanon will bear the brunt of all of the attacks, and they'll somehow manage to survive within all of this wreckage. As it turned out, they were specifically targeted, and they continue to be targeted with far less fallout on the general population. Of course, there are displaced people, there is some collateral damage, but these strikes have been fairly precise in, you know, in terms of overall war experiences.
Well, we are grateful for your safety in the meantime. Monday is October 7th, the first anniversary of the Hamas terrorist attack on Israel. EWTN News in Depth last spoke to you in December of last year, just 2 months after the start of Israel's military response to Hamas. At the time, you said, quote, "The last thing we want is for the war in Gaza to spread northwards and for escalation to take place." Well, here we are. What do you think went wrong that allowed the situation to spiral towards a regional war?
Well, a number of things. First of all, there has been very little appreciation in Lebanon and generally on the side of the proxies of Iran and Iran itself of the existential impact of what happened on October 7 with respect to Israel. This was not going to be, you know, a repeat of the 2006 war. So there was a great potential for escalation. Now, of course, we have seen that Israel, after tolerating months and months of unprovoked attacks by Hezbollah, which started on October 8, the day after the Hamas attack from Gaza on Israel, totally unprovoked, the Israelis seem to have had enough. And now they have a new they have a new war goal, which is to return their displaced 80 or so thousand residents from northern Israel that have come under months and months of sustained rocket fire from Hezbollah. So this was obviously going to be the trigger to expand the war. The intransigence of Iran and its proxies, Hezbollah specifically, is really responsible for this escalation. I can't single out any other factor than this. Back in November of last year, I wrote a small article in which I said that Iran should get zero rewards in Lebanon. Well, I'm happy to see that Iran, nobody's in a mood to give Iran any further rewards in Lebanon. In fact, what it already has in Lebanon may be eroding as we speak.
Can you please explain to our audience who may not have a clear picture on this, what the vast majority of the Lebanese population thinks about Hezbollah, the Islamic militant group and Iran proxy that has so much power in Lebanon? What was the reaction when Israeli airstrikes in Beirut targeted and killed Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah 1 week ago?
Well, even before the death of Nasrallah, I can say the majority of Lebanese were opposed to Hezbollah, and to the fact that Hezbollah has actually been protecting the corrupt mafia ruling class that has defrauded the country since 2019. It has brought on total political paralysis in the country. It is responsible for the economic and financial collapse of the country. They have created their own enclave. They declare war and without consulting anybody in Lebanon. So all of this has been, you know, part of the grievance, a very justified grievance that the majority of Lebanese communities have with regard to Hezbollah. And so when Nasrallah's own personal demise came, people were not going to disguise the fact that they were relieved. In fact, many were elated at his departure, simply because they consider him responsible for much of the misery that Lebanon has been going through for years, if not decades.
Mm. Do you see a diplomatic solution that would end this regional conflict? And what can the United States do? What can the non-Hezbollah Lebanese population do to bring peace?
Look, definitely we need to have a president elected in Lebanon. It has been almost 3 years without a president, and Hezbollah is largely responsible for that. Now, the timing of that and making sure that the mafia militia cartel, as it were, protected and led by Hezbollah, does not manage to get their puppet candidate as president, this is a tricky situation. I'm not really reassured that the Biden administration knows the proper timing for bringing about the presidency. There are excellent candidates who are very competent, I think, in working to revive Lebanon and restore many of its broken institutions. But for them to have a chance to become president, I think that requires a further erosion of the mafia militia cartel's clutch on Lebanon. So we shall see, you know, whether things, developments on the ground in terms of the war hasten the bringing about of presidential elections and a diplomatic solution, or whether people opt for that and end up risking botching it because the forces of obstruction are still not weakened sufficiently. Mm. We don't know yet.
Mm. With my minute remaining with you, finally, more than 1 million Lebanese have already been displaced from their homes as they seek safety from Israeli airstrikes in southern Lebanon. The U.S. State Department has encouraged all Americans to evacuate the country. You remain in your home. What do you see as the future for yourself and for the Lebanese people?
Well, look, we have a big problem now with displaced hundreds of thousands of people, mostly Shiites from southern Lebanon, further up north. And many are going to the Bekaa. Some have gone to Syria. Some have even gone as far as North Lebanon is concerned. On the human and humanitarian side, people have tried to, you know, open up schools and vacant buildings and so on to help absorb these internal refugees. However, given the fact that among them there could be infiltrators from Hezbollah and these could be targeted by Israel, many communities are very reluctant to receive these people. And so there have been some instances of friction, thankfully not too many. But this is down the road. This is going to be a huge problem because returning any of these people back to the south and to their destroyed villages is not going to happen anytime soon. The Bekaa Valley can, in theory, absorb quite a lot of them. But this is still a very fluid situation, I can say, from a security point of view. Mm,
absolutely. Well, Dr. Malik, thank you for joining us, and we'll continue to pray for your safety. Thank you.
Thank you.
Of course, EWTN News will continue to closely monitor the escalating events in the Middle East with coverage across all of our news platforms.
In the past, you have supported a federal ban on abortion after 15 weeks. Why have you changed your position?
In the spotlight, the vice presidential candidates answer questions about abortion, paid family leave, and child tax credits in their one and only debate. Details ahead.
They have told me by seeing my pictures, I'm taking them on like a virtual tour of these sacred places.
And a Catholic photographer on a mission. The faith journey of this man, determined to take pictures of every Catholic cathedral and basilica in America.
When this is over, we need to shake hands this election, and the winner needs to be the winner. This has got to stop. It's tearing our country apart.
We are going to shake hands after this debate and after this election. And, of course, I hope that we win, and I think we're going to win. But if Tim Walz is the next vice president, he'll have my prayers. He'll have my best wishes.
It was called a civil debate. The first and only vice presidential debate this election season came and went on Tuesday night. Anyone expecting fireworks might have been surprised. Republican J.D. Vance showed the polish of a trained Yale Law School lawyer. Democrat Tim Walz came across as more of a plain-spoken Midwest governor. Both men's focus seemed more trained on attacking the top of the ticket than on each other. Mark Irons has our EWTN News Election report.
The vice presidential debate had an air of civility.
First of all, thanks, Governor.
Thank you, Senator Vance.
And even areas of common ground.
And I think that Governor Walz and I actually probably agreed.
And I think there's a lot of agreement.
But the areas of disagreement were also clear, including on foreign affairs as war continues in the Middle East.
We need the steady leadership that Kamala Harris is providing.
Donald Trump actually delivered stability in the world, and he did it by establishing effective deterrence.
On border security and immigration, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz blamed Donald Trump for telling Republicans to stop the passage of a bipartisan reform bill earlier this year.
As soon as I was getting ready to pass and actually tackle this, Donald Trump said no. Told them to vote against it because it gives him a campaign issue.
U.S. Senator J.D. Vance said Vice President Kamala Harris has failed to enforce border security. He also shared how he believes Donald Trump's proposal to deport undocumented immigrants could be carried out, starting with criminals.
I think you start with deportations on those folks. And then I think you make it harder for illegal aliens to undercut the wages of American workers.
The economy and tax policy was debated.
Kamala Harris has said to do the things she wants to do, we'll just ask the wealthiest to pay their fair share.
To all of you watching, we can get back to an America that's affordable again.
Health care and the future of the Affordable Care Act was also discussed.
Kamala Harris will protect and enhance the ACA.
But I think that Donald Trump has earned the right to put in place some better health care policies.
Meanwhile, on abortion, Vance, a Catholic convert, said it should be left up to the states to decide.
Let the individual states make their abortion policy, and I think that's what makes the most sense.
During the debate, Donald Trump tweeted, "I would not support a federal abortion ban under any circumstances and would, in fact, veto it." Kamala Harris has said she wants to restore abortion access at the federal level by codifying the provisions in Roe v. Wade.
We're pro-women. We're pro-freedom to make your own choice.
Vance asked how far Walz, a Lutheran who was raised Catholic, would go in support of abortion.
Do you want to force Catholic hospitals to perform abortions against their will?
And he said a Minnesota bill Walz signed doesn't provide protection for infants who have survived abortion attempts.
That is fundamentally barbaric.
Later, Walz questioned Vance if he believes Donald Trump lost the 2020 election.
He is still saying he didn't lose the election. I would just ask that. Did he lose the 2020 election?
Tim, I'm focused on the future. Did Kamala Harris censor Americans from speaking their mind in the wake of the 2020 COVID situation?
That is a damning non-answer.
Gun violence across America came up with Vance saying a mental health crisis is in part to blame.
But I do think it's a big piece of it.
Sometimes it just is the guns.
Walz and Vance were also asked how they would respond to the issue of climate change.
Senator Vance has said that there's a climate problem in the past. Donald Trump called it a hoax.
Donald Trump and I support clean air, clean water.
On the topic of child care and options for a child tax credit, both men seem to find common ground.
You know, I think there is a bipartisan solution here.
But I'm not opposed to what he's talking about on options.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in depth.
Joining us now for analysis of this vice presidential debate, we're joined by two Catholic writers who closely follow politics. Madeline Kearns is associate editor at the Free Press. Leah Labresco Sargent is a contributor to Deseret News. Thank you both for being here. In this week's vice presidential debate, there was a lengthy exchange over Minnesota's law in which Tim Walz removed requirements to try and save babies born after an abortion. Here's a clip of that exchange.
You're free to disagree with me on this and explain this to me, but as I read the Minnesota law that you signed into law, the statute that you signed into law, it says that a doctor who presides over an abortion where the baby survives, the doctor is under no obligation to provide life-saving care to a baby who survives a botched late-term abortion. That is, I think,
that's
whether you're
true.
Pro-choice or pro-abortion, that is fundamentally barbaric.
These are women's decisions to make about their healthcare decisions and the physicians who know best when they need to do this. Trying to distort the way a law is written to try and make a point, that's not it
but
at
what
all.
What was I wrong this about, were, Governor? Please tell me. What was
that
wrong about?
That is not the way the law is written. Look, I've given
but
this.
But how? I asked a specific question, Governor. You gave me a slogan as a response.
It's not the case. It's not true. That's not what the law says. So they fact-checked it with President Trump.
Madeline, what did you think of that exchange, and how has the media been reporting and, quote, fact-checking on this Minnesota law?
Well, I think the problem is that this is actually quite a simple thing. Either the law says this or it doesn't. And it's easy to find out. You just look up the law. And yes, indeed, Governor Walz signed a bill that removed this line. The line was, quote, medical personnel had to preserve the life and health of the born alive infant, end quote. He removed that. Now the law says that they have to care for the infant who is born alive. But of course, care can mean anything. Care can mean you wrap them in a blanket and wait for them to die. So my question is, why wouldn't he answer this question head on? And I think the answer to that is because the truth makes him look bad. There's not any reason that you would remove this part of the law, this protection for born alive infants, unless you thought that born alive infants should be left to die, or at least it should be up to women to decide if they should be left to die. This is a serious problem. And of course, the media fact checkers who lean pro-choice are not going to draw attention to this. And so it was left to Senator Vance to draw attention to this. And he called it, accurately in my view, fundamentally barbaric.
As the debate was taking place, former President Donald Trump announced on social media he will veto a, quote, federal abortion ban if he is reelected. Leah, I'm curious, what stood out to you on how the candidates discussed the abortion issue at this debate? And I'm interested to hear your thoughts specifically on how the Republicans' messaging on the life issue is this election.
I think there's a pretty big split between the messaging that's coming from former President Trump and also from his wife, Melania, who reiterated her commitment to pro-choice rhetoric this week, versus the messaging that was coming from Senator Vance during the debate. One thing that impressed me a lot was him saying, you know, the reason the pro-life movement is losing referendum is because we don't have the trust of the people who are voting. And that he said, you know, it's our job to do a better job at earning the American people's trust back on this issue where they frankly just don't trust us. Mm. And if we think about the last 50 years of the pro-life movement as being about clearing the way to be able to pass laws, you know, the next 10 years are about building up the trust to be able to pass laws now that Roe doesn't make it impossible to pass them. Mm,
there's a lot of work to do on that front as well. Madeline, one topic that did not come up was the transgender issue. Were you surprised by that? And how much of a factor is the transgender issue in this election?
Well, I was surprised that it didn't come up. Of course, other things didn't come up that are very much newsworthy and worthy of talking about, like Ukraine. The moderator spent 8 minutes on climate change, but didn't think to mention this war in Europe. So, yes, that was surprising. I think that Governor Walz would have a difficult job of defending his record on transgenderism. So, for instance, in Minnesota is a supposedly, quote unquote, trans refuge state. That means that if a runaway child goes to Minnesota and seeking so-called gender-affirming care, these surgical interventions and medical interventions, they can get it without the permission of their parents. That is wildly out of step with the views of the American public, and it would have been good to see Senator Vance press Governor Walz on that. Of course, Kamala Harris has also been radical on these issues. She was she signed on to the Equality Act, which would have redefined sex in federal law to include gender identity. And so, yeah, I think this is an issue that people care about and they would have a difficult job defending. Mm.
This debate was also marked by a lot of agreement between the candidates, and including on the topic of child care and child tax credits. Let's take a listen to this.
A number of my Republican colleagues and some Democrats, too, have worked on this issue. And I think there is a bipartisan solution here because a lot of us care about this issue. A lot of young women would like to go back to work immediately. Some would like to spend a little time home with the kids. Some would like to spend longer at home with the kids. We should have a family care model that makes choice possible.
Whether it's 5,000 or 6,000, that plays you about 3 or 4 months. Let's be clear of where we're at on this. It's because we got out of an imbalance on this. We thought we were going to get by not paying people. I don't think Senator Vance or that and I are that far apart. I'm not opposed to what he's talking about on options. We've done scholarship types of things. I think we need to be open to making the case.
Leah, you have written extensively about child care and child tax credits. Is this a bipartisan issue now? And what have you made on the evolution of this topic?
I think in some ways there's no way it can't be a bipartisan issue. Everyone is competing for family votes, and everyone, insofar as they're reality-based, know that our safety net doesn't do a good enough job protecting parents, especially mothers, during those first few months after a baby is born, when she's still recovering and the baby needs her most. I'd love to see an expansion of paid family leave. I've benefited from it myself. But I do think the CTC and a possible baby bonus are one way of giving a baseline amount of protection to all families, regardless of whether your work offers time off, regardless of whether you're a student and don't have access to paid time off. A generous baby bonus allows every family to make the choice that's right for them by giving them the space away from work to make that choice.
I'm curious to see how it continues to play out as this election continues. Both vice presidential candidates have Catholic connections. J.D. Vance is an adult convert to Catholicism, and Tim Walz was raised in a Catholic home. Madeline, how have the two campaigns been reaching out to faith-based voters? And you've recently written about how it's a, quote, regrettable move for the country that the Harris campaign says they're skipping their prominent Al Smith Catholic charity dinner. Should both campaigns be doing more to reach out to Catholic voters?
Absolutely. I think Kamala Harris is kind of on the back foot here. She has a record of being aggressive with especially pro-life Catholics. She's tried to, as Attorney General of California, she tried to force pregnancy resource centers to advertise abortions. The Supreme Court said she couldn't do that. So definitely she should be doing everything she can to reach out to Catholics and to reassure them that, they are going to be welcome in her, under her administration. I think the Al Smith dinner is a opportunity for Americans to come together, to inject a bit of levity and humor and goodwill, which is much needed, into the political conversation. And so I think her skipping it, which is really, you know, it's a big deal. It's most, I think there's only been one other case in the last 40 years of somebody skipping it. That is really, you know, it's, I wouldn't say contemptuous, but it's pretty close to contemptuous sign to Catholics.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Leah, J.D. Vance's skills from Yale Law School were on full display at the debate stage. You're a Yale graduate yourself who enjoys the art of the argument and healthy debate. I'm curious what you thought overall, Leah, of the substance and rhetoric of the Vance-Wall matchup and what it reveals about the health of our political rhetoric.
You know, I think it was obvious to everyone that J.D. was having a pretty good time on the stage. But what I think was really notable is that element of agreement that came out repeatedly. It really felt, watching the debate, like Senator Vance was actively competing for votes, trying to find common points, trying to say, you know, if Walz is bringing up a concern about housing, here's my take on this common problem. There were a lot of moments. I felt like the VP debate, kind of absent the headline personalities, wound up as the more kitchen table issue debate. People concerned about housing, jobs, inflation, immigration all came up, and both candidates were agreeing those were some of the most pressing problems for their voters and putting forth much more clearly their claims about how they could be addressed.
Madeline, we have just about a minute left and also just a month left of this election. I want to give you the last word. Any final thoughts on how significant a VP debate even is and your lasting impressions?
Well, I think that it's obviously not as significant as the presidential debate, but it matters that we're introduced to these candidates who could be second in command come November. And so I think that it was effective in portraying those characters, drawing attention to their differences. And I agree with Leah that I think ultimately Senator Vance did win the night in terms of his performance and his confidence in handling the issues.
Madeline and Leah, thank you both for joining me and for your thoughtful analysis. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
For information about voting from a Catholic perspective, you can turn to the EWTN 2024 Voter Guide. It covers issues ranging from abortion and life to immigration to foreign policy to the economy. It is available on the website of our sister publication, the National Catholic Register, at ncregister.com. And this note of interest: in her new memoir, former First Lady Melania Trump, a Catholic, declares herself a lifelong advocate for abortion, breaking from her husband's campaign stance on the issue. She writes in her self-titled book to be released next week that there is no room for compromise on what she calls a woman's fundamental right. Asked for his reaction, Donald Trump said he told his wife she should write what she believes. News headlines are next. In the Week in Review, a big development in that dock worker strike that threatened to interrupt America's supply chain. The final session of the Synod on Synodality begins at the Vatican. And happy birthday to a president who has lived faith first. The suspension of a major East Coast port strike tops the Week in Review. It was the first strike of its kind since the 70s and stoked fears of a severe disruption to the supply chain. More than 50,000 port workers on the East Coast and Gulf of Mexico returned to the job on Friday after 3 days on the picket line. The International Longshoremen's Association began the strike to rally for higher pay and more job security. The union agreed on Thursday to extend its contract with the Maritime Alliance until January 15th and includes an annual raise of $4 an hour. The strike suspension gives more time to bargain over remaining issues. Association members say they're excited to be back to work.
It means that they can provide, put food on the table, pay their bills. They don't have to worry anymore, possibly losing their cars or their homes or anything like that.
The East and Gulf Coast ports handle about half of all goods shipped in and out of the U.S. Economic experts had worried the shutdown could have a widespread impact, severely hampering the flow of goods and raising shipping costs, a strain that could be passed to consumers. Georgia's Republican Attorney General is asking the state Supreme Court to intervene after a lower court this week struck down the state's pro-life law. The LIFE Act protected unborn babies after 6 weeks, around the time a heartbeat can be detected. Because of this week's ruling, for now, abortion is legal through 22 weeks of pregnancy in Georgia. The pro-life law first went into effect in 2022 and was upheld by the state Supreme Court last year. The U.S. Supreme Court begins a new round of oral arguments next week with a few hot-button issues already on the docket. The High Court makes its return while still plagued by ethics scandals, unsolved leaks of confidential information, and apparent ideological divisions among its members. This new term comes after a blockbuster session last year when the court ruled on guns, the power of federal agencies, and the immunity of presidents from criminal prosecution. So far, the Supreme Court has decided to take up a case on the regulation of ghost guns, untraceable firearms that are built from kits or separate pieces. The court will also look at Tennessee's law that bans gender transition treatments for minors, as well as a Texas law that requires pornographic websites to verify the age of visitors in order to crack down on underage users. Important meetings began at the Vatican this Wednesday with the start of the second and last session of the Synod on Synodality. The month-long gathering of church leaders and lay people will provide recommendations to Pope Francis on a path forward for the future of the Catholic Church. Dr. Matthew Bunsen, editorial director for EWTN News, has our report.
On Wednesday morning, the Holy Father presided over the opening Mass of the concluding session of the Synod on Synodality that will run until the end of October.
The Church, by its very vocation, is a welcoming place of gathering where collegial charity demands perfect harmony.
This month's assembly completes the journey begun last year on the theme for a synodal church: communion, participation, mission. Over the next weeks, bishops, priests, men and women religious, and lay people from around the world will gather every day at the Vatican. This session will be different from last year in a significant way, however. Pope Francis has asked that the discussions focus more explicitly on ways the Church can be truly synodal, becoming a listening, accompanying, and welcoming Catholic community. The more controversial issues that were raised at last year's session, such as women deacons, outreach to LGBTQ Catholics, and authority in the church, have been handed over to 10 study groups who are expected to conclude their work in June.
Il sinodo, data la sua importanza.
In his homily at the opening Mass, Pope Francis emphasized the need for hearts to be open to dialogue and the importance of the harmony that comes from the Holy Spirit. The Pope also called for a day of prayer and fasting for peace on the 7th of October, the one-year anniversary of the outbreak of the Israel-Hamas war. A penitential vigil preceded the opening of the Synod Assembly on Tuesday night. During the ceremony, the Pope and seven cardinals expressed shame and asked forgiveness on behalf of all in the Church for sins against peace, against the environment, against the dignity of women, against the poor, and for sins of abuse.
On the eve of the solemn opening of the Synod, confession is an opportunity to restore trust in and towards the Church, a trust shattered by our mistakes and sins.
The second session of the Synod will end on Sunday, October 27th, with a closing Mass in St. Peter's Basilica. It is expected that, as usual, the Synod will present to Pope Francis a final document based on the conversations of the previous weeks.
For EWTN News in Depth, I'm Matthew Bunsen.
We have a whole team of EWTN journalists covering the Synod from the National Catholic Register and Catholic News Agency. For broadcast, Matthew Bunsen and I will also join the team in Rome, along with Father Thomas Petrie of the Dominican House of Studies. We will have TV coverage and commentary of the Synod during the closing week, October 21st through 27th. A historical first in Mexico on Tuesday, when Claudia Sheinbaum was sworn in as the country's first female president and the first president of Jewish heritage in the predominantly Catholic nation. Mexico's outgoing president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, handed over the presidential sash on the floor of Congress as legislators shouted, Presidenta, Presidenta, the feminine form of president in Spanish for the first time in Mexico's 200-year history. Later that day, Sheinbaum attended a huge rally in Mexico City's main plaza, where she received a staff of authority from an elder during a traditional indigenous ceremony. Sheinbaum's task will not be easy. She inherits a sluggish economy, powerful drug cartels, and her first trip will be to the flood-stricken Pacific Coast town of Acapulco. Sheinbaum has been vocal in her support for abortion, which she believes is a right. Birthday greetings are in order for our country's 39th president. On Tuesday, Jimmy Carter turned 100 years old, the oldest living president in American history. Carter took the oath of office in 1977, a one-term president. One of his biggest achievements was the Camp David Accords. The end of his presidency was marked by the Iran hostage crisis, an energy crisis, and the Three Mile Island nuclear accident. Carter is perhaps most admired for what he accomplished in his post-presidency. He traveled globally to conduct peace negotiations, monitor elections, and help to eradicate infectious diseases. He received a Nobel Peace Prize in 2002 for his human rights work. He was also a key figure in the nonprofit housing organization Habitat for Humanity. His beloved wife, Rosalind, to whom he was married for 77 years, died last November. On his birthday, the Naval Academy graduate and former Navy officer was honored with a Navy jet flyover, which he watched from his backyard, surrounded by his family. A lifelong Baptist, Jimmy Carter was the first U.S. president to welcome a pope to the White House when he greeted Pope John Paul II in 1979. While he does hold views that differ from Catholic teaching on a number of issues, Carter has led a life of faith, perhaps more visibly than any other president in American history. We recommend a retrospective on Carter's faith life published this week in EWTN's Catholic News Agency if you'd like to learn more. Next, bringing inspiration to others through his photography, we catch up with a man on a mission as he illustrates Catholic life through the camera lens. Finally today, a Catholic photographer is on a unique mission, traveling the country to capture images of inspiration. His faith journey began as a young man while contemplating the beauty of a church at an Easter Sunday Mass. Here's reporter Roselle Regis.
Andrew
Macy has always loved visiting Catholic churches to admire their beauty and architecture.
I love to see them in person, you know, to take in their beauty and to take pictures.
He has an ambitious mission to photograph all 193 cathedrals and 93 basilicas across the United States. He goes by the name The Catholic Photographer on social media, where hundreds of people follow him and look through pictures of all the places he has visited. Macy tells us that he owes his life to Jesus and that this years-long journey has only brought him closer to the Lord.
Every new place I go to, a new cathedral, a new basilica, or shrine, or church, wherever, I just thank God that I have the opportunity to do so.
Macy was born in Colombia and was adopted from an orphanage by an Italian-American couple who brought him to the United States. At 6 months old, Macy battled meningitis. Doctors weren't sure he would survive. Miraculously, he did. However, as a result of the disease, he suffered hearing loss. Macy says with a great support system, he didn't let his disability affect his life. Macy was brought up Lutheran, but he was always intrigued by Catholicism. His father was a church musician and was invited to perform during the Diocese of Bridgeport's 50th anniversary celebration in 2003. Macy followed his father to the event and said he was captivated by the homily. A couple of years later, at the age of 18, he converted to Catholicism.
And ever since then, I haven't looked back. I've been enjoying every moment of it so far.
Then in 2014, just 2 weeks after his grandmother passed away, he felt God calling to him again. He attended Mass at the Cathedral Basilica of the Sacred Heart in Newark, New Jersey, on Easter Sunday. While waiting for Mass to begin, he looked around the church and thought to himself,
I wonder if every cathedral across the United States look at just as magnificent and big and grand as this one. That's what God put the sign in me, told me the sign to go out and see it, but photograph them myself.
That's when his life-changing spiritual pilgrimage began. His most recent trip was to the nation's capital, where he stopped by the Cathedral of St. Matthew the Apostle, before driving to Virginia. There, he attended Mass at the Basilica of St. Mary's in Alexandria and visited the newly renovated Cathedral of St. Thomas More in Arlington.
The new cathedral is a complete transformation. It's a great honor and it's a compliment, right, that you would want to come here to take pictures, to be able to see what is this cathedral about, and then to be able to share it with others.
Macy is simple. Using just his smartphone, he takes pictures of everything inside and outside of the church. He has gained followers over the years, and the feedback has been nothing but positive.
They would tell me, I feel like I'm there with you. You're like my tour guide, virtual tour guide, and seeing these beautiful places and the bonus.
In the coming months, Macy's next stops will include Oklahoma, Colorado, Wyoming, and Indiana. He plans to complete his mission in a few years. Macy hopes to inspire others to be closer to our Lord and reminds everyone, through his photographs, that the beautiful house of Jesus always welcomes people.
Jesus is always there for you. Come home to the Lord. He's always there for you.
Rosal Regis, EWTN News in Depth.
How beautiful. And that's a wrap on this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. Join us again same time next week for more news and reports important to your Catholic life. Until then, God bless.